My name is Bill Saunders. I am the chairman of the Religious Liberties Practice Group of the Federalist Society. And this is the panel that we are sponsoring here at the convention. I'm glad to see you all here, and I invite you, if you haven't, to join the Religious Liberties Practice Group. Either you could ask Dean Reuter, or you can ask me or somebody else if you need to find out how to sign up, but we welcome you to joining the Religious Liberties Practice Group. So that's the end of my role. I just want to welcome the man who will be moderating the panel and introducing our speakers, which are a great friend of the Federalist Society, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Dermot O'Scanlan.
Thank you very much, Bill, and let me add my welcome to you this afternoon for a panel discussion on a rather topical subject. I thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to moderate this panel and for choosing a timely and important topic, which I will quote again, religious liberty and conflicting moral visions. Many view religious freedom as the cornerstone of all human rights. Others see conscientious scruples as impediments to human rights. How does the law and our civil society address the intersection of these two views? The question is pressing. Last term, of course, the Supreme Court in United States versus Windsor indicated that the federal government may not constitutionally define marriage as the union between a man and a woman. Windsor is perhaps not the end of the question, but the beginning. Must states now recognize same-sex unions as marriages? Where the law recognizes same-sex marriages as such, what protections must and should it afford to religious objectors? Can and should individuals or their businesses be compelled to provide services for same-sex ceremonies under penalty of law? The questions are not limited to marriage. The Senate last week approved the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would, among other things, prohibit discrimination in employment on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. What types of employers must or should be exempt on religious freedom grounds from such requirements? We've also seen a flurry of litigation, and most recently, the deepening of a circuit split concerning the contraception mandate found in the Affordable Care Act. The 7th and D.C. circuits last week, like the 10th Circuit before them, enjoined the application of the law to claimants who oppose certain contraceptive procedures on religious grounds. The Third and Sixth Circuits have declined to do so. The opinions on both sides of the split raise serious questions about the nature and priority of religious exercise. Does a corporation have standing to assert free exercise claims? Do its shareholders? Must the corporation forsake profit to do so? Two more and perhaps more poignant questions. Does compulsion to fund a practice violative of one's religious beliefs necessarily burden the free exercise of religion? How would the government compel such funding in the most narrowly tailored way? In these and other areas, the ultimate question may be how the law can or should reconcile the claims of religious liberty with the claims of those whose priorities challenge the primacy of conscience. We have an exceptionally capable panel to help us sort out these questions. I will introduce them briefly and direct your attention to their biographical details elsewhere. We will hear from each panelist in turn, followed by discussion among the panel members, and then finally, your questions. William Galston is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. A former advisor to President Clinton, he played a prominent role in shepherding the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA as we have come to know it, into law. Professor Galston will tell us why Justice Scalia's opinion in Smith versus Employment Division is wrong. Kyle Duncan is general counsel of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He has recently represented clients in numerous cases challenging the contraception mandate found in the Affordable Care Act, and his remarks will focus on this litigation. Andrew Koppelman is John Paul Stevens Professor of Law at Northwestern University. He has published widely on issues of law and philosophy, including religious liberties and same-sex marriage. His comments will address issues at the intersection of gay rights and religious liberty. Robbie George is professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University. He is chair of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and has recently published with Ryan Anderson and Sharif Gerges, What is Marriage? His remarks will consider why the law cannot reach a grand bargain at the intersection of same-sex marriage, non-discrimination laws, and religious liberty. With that, let us begin with Professor Galston.
Well, thank you very much, Judge Hoskin. And thanks also to the Federalist Society for this invitation. To remain within my 8-minute limit, I will read my remarks, although that's generally a loathsome business. The First Amendment unmistakably singled out religion for special treatment, and it had compelling reasons for doing so. The members of the first U.S. Congress who endorsed the language of the First Amendment and sent it to the states for ratification knew all too well about religious strife. They knew as well that the repression of religious differences had been characterized by exceptional cruelty, and that the exercise of those differences went to the core of individual identity. The man who produced the initial draft of the First Amendment was also the author of the famous Memorial and Remonstrance, which had placed each individual's understanding of duties owed to the Creator above or outside the proper scope of civil law. Religious free exercise, said James Madison, was, and I quote, in its nature an inalienable right, close quote. It followed that proposals to limit religious free exercise would have a heavy burden of proof to discharge. No one doubted or doubts the propriety of certain time, place, and manner restrictions. Free exercise doesn't entail the right to conduct a loud revival meeting in a residential neighborhood at 2 a.m. In such circumstances, religious noise is on all fours with its secular counterpart. But how far does this legal parity extend? No one would seriously argue that the claims of religious free exercise extend to human sacrifice, as opposed to animal sacrifice, which does enjoy First Amendment protection. There are, more generally, some bedrock civil concerns that the law may enforce regardless of their effects on particular religions. But for most of our national history, legislators and jurists have distinguished between such concerns and the more typical objects of legislation, which were not thought to be so fundamental as to outweigh religious free exercise. Despite the obvious importance of communal self-defense, for example, many colonies exempted Quakers from serving in battles against the French and Native Americans, an exemption that some colonies continued during the Revolutionary War. Madison and the members of the first U.S. Congress were well aware of this. The oft-heard contention that the drafters of the First Amendment did not contemplate and would have opposed the regime of religious liberty and religious accommodation codified in Sherbert v. Verner does not pass the test of historical fidelity, in my opinion. Many episodes since the ratification of the First Amendment testify to the persistence of this concern. Not only our draft laws, but also what is arguably the least successful constitutional innovation in our nation's history. So let me describe that. It was widely understood that without the concurrent legislation authorized in Section 2 of the 18th Amendment, its general prohibition on the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcoholic beverages would be too vague to enforce. On October 29, 1919, the National Prohibition Act, popularly known as the Volstead Act, which created the legal definition of intoxicating liquor and specified penalties for producing it, passed over President Wilson's veto and stood as the law of the land until 1933. The Volstead Act created a number of exemptions to the prohibition regime, of which two were especially noteworthy. First, the act allowed physicians to prescribe liquor to individuals for medicinal purposes and to employ it pursuant to treatment for alcoholism in certified treatment programs. Second, the act stated that nothing it contained should be construed as applying to wine for sacramental purposes or like religious rites, and it permitted the sale or transfer of wine to rabbis, ministers, priests, or an officer duly authorized by any church or congregation. Now, suppose that the act had not exempted physicians. The omission would have been subject to criticism on policy grounds, but no one would have suggested that it ran afoul of constitutional norms. If the act had failed to exempt wine for sacramental purposes, on the other hand, there would have been both a political firestorm and a First Amendment challenge. The use of sacramental wine lies at the heart of more than one religion. The Code of Canon Law of the Catholic Church prescribes, and I quote, "The most holy sacrifice of the Eucharist must be celebrated in bread and in wine to which a small quantity of water is to be added. For its part, Jewish law commands the drinking of wine during the Passover Seder, specifying not only the famous four cups, but also a minimum quantity for each cup to be consumed. As Seder attenders know, there is no maximum specified." Comprehensive prohibition without exemptions would have prevented faithful Jews and Catholics from behaving as their religion requires. The Constitution's presumption in favor of free exercise is designed to reduce to an unavoidable minimum the circumstances in which such clashes are resolved in favor of the state. In his majority opinion in the leading religious liberty case of our time, Employment Division v. Smith, Justice Antonin Scalia rejected this entire way of thinking. If a law is neutral on its face, of general application, and directed to matters within the state's competence, Scalia argued, the mere fact that it has the effect of selectively burdening the free exercise of religion is neither here nor there. The state has no burden of proof that it must meet. Quite the reverse, he said. Any society adopting a presumption in favor of religious free exercise would be, and I quote, courting anarchy. The greater the religious diversity within a polity, the greater the risk. So even fundamental rights must be subjected to the democratic process. And if that means that minority views are systematically disadvantaged in that process, tough luck. I quote again. That unavoidable consequence of democratic government must be preferred to a system in which each conscience is a law unto itself. Close quote. Thomas Hobbes could not have put it any better. Although the Smith case revolved around Oregon's drug laws, its reach is much broader. If the Volstead Act had not exempted sacramental wine and the Catholic Church had brought suit, a Justice Scalia transported back to the 1920s would have been compelled to reject its claim. Can this possibly be the right result? Does Smith express the best understanding of the First Amendment? Well, I think Smith fails the test at the level of principle, but it fails it at the level of practice as well, because experience undercuts Scalia's parade of horribles. During the three decades that Sherbert was the controlling legal authority, our legal system proved perfectly capable of distinguishing between legitimate and counterfeit conscientious claims. Our courts did not court anarchy, and they did not unleash it. Madison's first draft of what became the First Amendment read, and I quote, "The civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established, nor shall the full and equal rights of conscience be in any manner or on any pretext infringed." What Scalia sees as Pandora's box, Madison regarded as the animating principle of our constitutional order. In this, as in so many other matters, we should remain faithful Madisonians.
Mr. Duncan.
Thank you, Judge O'Scanlan. I'm grateful to the Federalist Society to be included on this great panel. Excuse me. My remarks will focus on the conflict of moral visions created by the federal contraceptive mandate, or the HHS mandate, and how it could affect American religious liberty. The HHS mandate is a regulation under the Affordable Care Act. It requires employer health insurance to cover all FDA-approved contraceptives and sterilization methods, including some emergency contraceptives that can cause early abortions. Exemptions for religious employers are narrow. Essentially, they're limited to houses of worship and religious orders. Not complying with the mandate exposes an employer to severe IRS penalties and other bad consequences. The mandate has provoked widespread litigation, something like 80 lawsuits by more than 200 plaintiffs. And suits by religious business owners have already produced a split among five circuits that may be taken up by the Supreme Court this term. The moral conflict posed by the mandate is obvious and dramatic. Mandate supporters believe that the widespread and effective use of contraceptives is good for everybody, good for women, for marriage, for children, and for society. So, to achieve that goal, the government has mandated that employer health insurance cover contraceptives without cost sharing. By contrast, religious opponents of the mandate believe that all or at least some contraceptives are bad for everybody, bad for women, for marriage, for children, and for society. And so they conscientiously oppose providing those drugs in their health plan. This is a sort of perfect storm of irreconcilable moral and political conflicts touching simultaneously on sex, procreation, women's equality, religion, federal power, and the Affordable Care Act. In the widespread litigation that has been provoked, employers claim that the mandate infringes their religious liberty under the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. Litigation of this magnitude will inevitably shape American religious freedom in important ways. I'd like to highlight two ways that seem important to me. And no, I'm not checking my email. I'm just making sure that I stay on time. First, the litigation will determine whether legal protection for religious exercise extends to people who run commercial businesses. The government has taken the position in these cases that neither a business nor its owners has any religious claim against the mandate. A business is supposedly secular by definition, and so cannot exercise religion as a matter of law. Its owner's faith is supposedly unaffected by the mandate, because only the business itself and its health plan must provide the coverage, and not the owners personally. On this theory, as Ed Whelan never tires of saying, a kosher deli would have no religious claim against a regulation forcing it to sell pork. By the same token, a business like Hobby Lobby, whom I represent, is purely secular, even though it makes numerous business decisions based only on religion, such as closing on Sundays, providing chaplains and spiritual counseling for employees, and taking out Christmas and Easter ads every year proclaiming Jesus as Lord and Savior. An array of circuit judges has already weighed in on either side of this question. For example, in the Hobby Lobby case, Judge Timkovich wrote this for the en banc 10th Circuit, and I quote, "A religious individual may enter the for-profit realm intending to demonstrate to the marketplace that a corporation can succeed financially while adhering to religious values. As a court, we do not see how we can distinguish this form of evangelism from any other," close quote. And dissenting in the Third Circuit's Conestoga Wood Specialties case, Judge Jordan wrote that the government's position in these cases, quote, "appears to be itself a species of religion based on the idea that seeking after filthy lucre is sin enough to deprive one of constitutional protection," close quote. On the other side, Judge Rovner wrote in her Seventh Circuit dissent just last week that because religion is, quote, "by its nature, an intensely individual experience, to say that religion may be exercised by a legal construct like a corporation is, quote, irreconcilable with the very essence of religious faith and, for that matter, humankind," close quote. Evidently, these cases have produced strong views on the nature of religious liberty, even on the nature of religion itself. The circuits are currently split 3-2, and the Supreme Court is scheduled to conference 4 cert petitions in these cases on November the 26th, including the Solicitor General's petition for cert in Hobby Lobby. Second, the mandate litigation will answer an important question about the nature of a religious burden under the First Amendment and RFRA. And I've lost my place. Sorry. This is an exceedingly important question, especially because it arises in the context of a federal restructuring of health insurance. What is this question, basically? Well, the technical term for this is what is a substantial burden on religious exercise? But the real question is whether an employer has a viable religious objection to being forced to provide a particular benefit to his or her employees. Again, the circuits are already deeply split on this question. Some, like the 10th, DC, and 7th circuits, say that the correct focus is on the employer's conviction that he cannot participate in a system that coerces him to provide objectionable benefits, such as the contraceptive coverage at issue. Probing any further into this, asking, for instance, whether the employer's role in the process is attenuated or indirect, immediately entangles courts in questions of theology. As Judge Timkovich wrote in the Hobby Lobby opinion, asking questions of that nature, quote, requires an inquiry into the theological merit of the belief in question, which is forbidden to secular courts. But again, other judges strongly disagree. For example, in her dissent last week, Judge Rovner wrote that to the contrary, courts, quote, must consider precisely how the objected to action relates to the individual's exercise of his religious rights, close quote. Judge Rovner would have ruled that the mandate's burden was not substantial because insurance benefits are essentially like wages, which the employee decides how to use privately. On that view, the employer's role in providing the coverage is attenuated, and the mandate therefore, quote, does not actually require the employers themselves to do anything contrary to their religious beliefs. This second question is as important as the first. It asks not only what a substantial burden is, but also about the proper role of courts in making theological determinations, which one would hope, I might add, to be zero. This question, too, is raised in the cert petitions that the Supreme Court will consider on November the 26th. Thank you very much.
Now we will hear from Professor Koppelman.
All right, I'm going to talk about gay rights and religious liberty. I'll start with a story. In September of 2006, Vanessa Willock sent an email to an Albuquerque business called Elaine Photography and asked it to photograph her wedding. Same-sex marriage, and she indicated that this was going to be a same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriages were not then and are not now legally recognized in New Mexico, but that doesn't stop those couples from celebrating their unions. And she received an emailed refusal, which explained that the company's policy forbids kids photographing same-sex unions. And the company's owner explained later that she's got a religious objection to facilitating such a ceremony. So Willick then brought a complaint with the State Human Rights Commission, which New Mexico law forbids businesses that offer their services to the general public from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. And the case went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and Elaine Photography lost each time. So the state Supreme Court upheld an award of more than $6,000 of attorney's fees and court costs. Now, I've been a gay rights advocate for more than 25 years, and very strongly in favor of same-sex marriage. And my view is that we've won this fight, basically, and I think that that's great. But today, I want to make common cause with Elaine Photography. I've worked very hard to create a regime in which it's safe to be gay. I would also like that regime to be one in which it's safe to be a religious dissenter. And the stakes, I think, go considerably beyond the gay rights issue. The Federal Society applauding me? Wait. I've presented this argument to audiences that are sympathetic with my views of same-sex marriage. I presented this argument to the Lavender Law Meeting, which is a very different group, and our arguments are about the consequences of accommodation. Really depends on what you think the purposes of anti-discrimination law are and what the consequences would be of some kind of accommodation. There is room to haggle about what that accommodation should look like. And I won't go into the details of disagreement about what it should look like. I'll just say there's an argument about whether to accommodate in this particular case. Well, the strongest argument for accommodation here is a pretty simple one. There are lots of other wedding photographers. And so if you think that it would be a severe harm to the same-sex couple to allow exclusion in this case, you've got to think, and the argument that I get back from my friends on the gay rights side is they do think that if you allow religious accommodations, there's going to be quite a lot of discrimination, and this is going to license a great deal of discrimination. I think that American culture has changed to the point where that is no longer credible. I've got limited amount of time. I'll just say that. And I think that the misunderstanding on the part of my friends who have been fighting with me for gay rights all this time if you're gay in the United States, you've had experiences of discrimination, open, unapologetic, hateful, sometimes violent. And if you're subjected to enough of that stuff, you're going to see it everywhere. In light of this experience, it's hard to get your mind around the fact that the vicious monster who once abused you is now in hospice care. But I want to say, go beyond that to, my time is half gone, to the question of why this is so politically hard. I mean, you'd think it's easy. There's not very many of these cases. If you look at the literature about conflicts between gay rights and religious liberty, it tends to focus on about half a dozen anecdotes in a country of 300 million people. It's just not a big problem. I think that the fundamental problem has to do with the division of American politics along religious lines and what gay rights has had to do with that. So there are really deep divisions. In the 2012 presidential election, 59% of those who attend church every week voted for Romney, compared with 34% of those who never attend services. And that pattern has persisted for years. And the proportion of Americans who report themselves as having no religious preference, the statisticians call them the nuns, easier to avoid confusion in writing than when you say it, In 1990, they were 8.2% of the population. Today, they're about 15% of the population. And about 27% of Americans do not expect a religious funeral. So how did this happen? How did so many people come to disaffiliate with religion? In Robert Putnam and David Campbell's study, American Grace, they argue that the big thing that happened was the liberalization of sexual mores in the 1960s, which mobilized religious conservatives against the change. They soon affiliated with the Republican Party. Conservative politics became the most visible aspect of religion in America. That produced a counter backlash, especially among those who came of age in the 1990s. And gay rights was a big part of that. People with gay-friendly views are more than twice as likely to say that they have no religion as their statistically similar peers who are conservative on homosexuality. So I think that there's an effect that Tocqueville pointed out in 1835 in Democracy in America. He said, the reason why anti-clericalism arose in Europe wasn't because of disagreement about theology. It was because religion had become identified with a conservative politics. And he thought that 19th century secular Frenchmen attack Christians more as political than as religious enemies. Well, I think that's what's happened in the United States. The culture wars have damaged the Christian brand. In 1990, 86% of American adults identified as Christian. That went down by 10 points by 2008. It's now 76%. Now, as the gay rights movement increasingly wins its battle, here's the good news for people who want American religiosity to be strong. I think that the heat of that conflict could abate. But meanwhile, and in part as a consequence of these developments, the idea of religion-specific accommodation has become controversial. If you think that religion just means irrational hatred, you're not inclined to accommodate it. And so there's this growing suspicion on the left of religion, identifying religion with political conservatism. Now, I think that this mistakes a historical blip for a permanent feature of the political world. The association of religion with political conservatism is a recent development. The social gospel movement of the late 19th century, the role of Catholics in the New Deal, the role of religious groups in the resistance to the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. Everything the American left has ever accomplished in American politics, it has done by alignment with the religious. So to the extent that there is this deep divide between the secular left and the religious, this is good news for American conservatism. And here, I'll come out again with my non-applause line, I'm not your friend. I don't think that this is a good thing. The culture wars have increasingly led regular churchgoers to ally with people who are determined above all to maintain the inequality of resources in contemporary American life. Some accommodation of and respect for the religion of the right can paradoxically encourage the religion of the left. And so that, I think, can offer us new and better ways of not being friends. Thank you.
Professor George.
Andy may not be your friend, but he's my friend. He's my dear old friend. We were colleagues together for 6 or 7 years at Princeton, and I miss him terribly. I miss having the opportunity on a regular basis to correct him. now it's only occasional. And it's wonderful to be on a panel, every member and the chairman of which are friends and old friends, and not only friends, but people that I deeply respect and have learned so much from. Well, Andy's job essentially today was to say, why can't we all get along, or can't we all get along? And I'm afraid my job is to say, no, we can't all get along, and let me say why. It was yesterday, only yesterday, was it not, that we were being assured that the redefinition of marriage to include same-sex partnerships would have no significant impact on persons and institutions that hold a traditional view of marriage as a conjugal union. Such persons and institutions would simply be untouched by the change. It won't affect your marriage or your life, we were told, if the law recognizes Henry and Herman or Sally and Sheila as married. Those offering these assurances were also claiming that the redefinition of marriage would have no impact on the public understanding of marriage as a monogamous and sexually exclusive partnership. No one, they insisted, wanted to alter those traditional marital norms, or if anyone did, it was a fringe element. On the contrary, the redefinition of marriage and all that came with it would promote and spread those norms more broadly. No one was seeking to redefine marriage. We were assured the goal was merely to broaden the pool of people eligible to participate in this wonderful institution. When some of us warned that all of this was nonsense and pointed out the myriad ways that Catholics, evangelicals, Mormons, Eastern Orthodox Christians, Orthodox Jews, Muslims, and others would be affected and their opportunities and liberties restricted by the legal recognition of same-sex partnerships and, relatedly, the insertion of the concept of sexual orientation into anti-discrimination statutes and ordinance, our liberal friends accused us of scaremongering. When we observed that reducing marriage to a form of sexual romantic companionship or domestic partnership, which is what happens when sexual reproductive complementarity is banished from the definition, removes any principled ground for understanding marriage as a sexually exclusive and faithful union of two and only two persons, and not an open partnership or a relationship of three or more persons, a polyamorous ensemble as it's called, we were charged with invalid slippery slope reasoning, remember? No one, they assured us, would require Christian foster care and adoption services to place children in same-sex-headed households. No one would require religiously affiliated schools and social service agencies to treat same-sex partners as spouses or impose penalties or disabilities on those that dissent. No one would be fired from his or her job or suffered employment discrimination for voicing support for conjugal marriage or criticizing same-sex sexual conduct and relationships. No business owners would be required to provide services for same-sex ceremonies that were contrary to the business owner's moral beliefs, or punished if he or she declined to provide them. And no one was proposing to recognize polyamorous relationships or normalize open marriages, nor would redefinition undermine the norms of sexual exclusivity and monogamy in theory and practice. That was then, this is now. I must say, though, that I still can't fathom why anybody believed any of it, even then. The whole argument was and is that the idea of marriage as the union of husband and wife lacks a rational basis and amounts to nothing more than bigotry, motivated no doubt by animus. Someone said that anyway. Therefore, no reasonable person of goodwill can dissent from the liberal position on sex and marriage any more than a reasonable person of goodwill could support racial segregation and subordination. And this because marriage, according to the redefiners, consists principally of companionship. The companionship of people committed to mutual affection and care, and any distinctions beyond this are baseless. Since most liberals, and even some conservatives, it seems, apparently have no understanding at all of the conjugal conception of marriage as what the Bible calls a one-flesh union, not even enough of a grasp to consciously consider and reject it on its rational merits, and although the Bible gives us the concept, the Bible is not unique in this. We can find the conjugal understanding of marriage in ancient writers untouched by Hebrew revelation, from Plato to Musonius, from Xenophanes to Plutarch. So people can't fathom how anyone could possibly understand it in any other way. This, despite the fact that the conjugal conception of marriage has historically been embodied in our laws of matrimony and explains their content, not just the requirement of spousal sexual complementarity, but also rules concerning legal consummation and annulability, norms of monogamy and sexual exclusivity, and the pledge of permanence of commitment in ways that the sexual romantic domestic partnership conception still cannot account for. Still, having adopted the sexual romantic domestic partnership idea and seeing no alternative possible conception of marriage, they assume, no actual reason can be said to exist for regarding sexual reproductive complementarity as integral to marriage. After all, two men or two women can have a romantic interest in each other, live together in a sexual partnership, care for each other, and so forth, so why can't they be married? Those who think otherwise have no rational basis for their view. They discriminate invidiously. They're motivated by animus, by the same, typically they're regarded as bigots. By the same token, if two men or two women can be married, why can't three or more people, irrespective of sex, in polyamorous triads or quadrads? You can read all about it these days on Salon or Slate or even in the mainstream news magazines. Since allegedly no reason supports the idea of marriage as a male-female union or a partnership of two persons and not three or more, the motive of those insisting on these other traditional norms must also be a dark and irrational one. My point that redefining marriage as sexual romantic companionship or domestic partnership to accommodate same-sex partnerships erodes the basis for permanence and exclusivity in any relationship is increasingly confirmed by the rhetoric and arguments of advocates of this view themselves. Here follows a lengthy series of quotations from mainstream writers and analysts, they're proof texting the point that I was making. I'll just name some of the people I quote from: Professor Elizabeth Brake, Professor Judith Stacey, the signers of the Manifesto Beyond Same-Sex Marriage, which includes recent Medal of Freedom winner Gloria Steinem, Barbara Ehrenreich, NYU Professor Kenji Yoshino. I also quote E.J. Graff, Dan Savage, Victoria Brownworth, Michelangelo Signorelli. Well, many advocates of redefining marriage, sensing that they have now won, it's just a mopping up operation and there's no turning back, are increasingly open in saying that they do not see these disputes about sex and marriage as honest disagreements among reasonable people of goodwill. They're rather battles between the forces of reason, enlightenment, and equality, those who would expand the circle of inclusion on the one side, and the forces of ignorance, bigotry, and discrimination, those who would exclude people out of hatred or animus, on the other side. The excluders are to be treated just as racists are treated, since they are the equivalent of racists. Now, of course, we in the United States, at least, don't put racists in jail for expressing their opinions. We respect the First Amendment. But we don't hesitate to stigmatize them and impose various forms of social and even civil disability on them and their institutions in the name of So in the name of marriage equality or anti-discrimination, liberty, especially religious liberty and liberty of conscience, really can be undermined. The fundamental error made by some supporters of conjugal marriage was and is, I believe, to imagine that a grand bargain could be struck with their opponents. We will accept the legal redefinition of marriage. You will respect our right to act on our consciences without penalty, discrimination, and civil disability of any type. Same-sex partners will get marriage licenses, but no one will be forced for any reason to recognize those marriages or suffer discrimination or disabilities in employment or licensing or accreditation or government contracting or any other area for declining to recognize them and become complicit in facilitating them. And here's my point about, no, we cannot get along. There was never any hope of such a bargain being accepted. Perhaps parts of such a bargain would be accepted by liberal forces temporarily for strategic or tactical reasons as part of the political project of getting marriage redefined in law. But guarantees of religious liberty and non-discrimination for people who cannot in conscience accept same-sex marriage could then be eroded and eventually removed. After all, full equality requires that no quarter be given to bigots who would engage in discrimination in the name of their retrograde religious beliefs. Dignitarian harm, as it's come to be known, must be opposed as resolutely as more palpable forms of harm. And there's a reason for this. Liberal secularism never was and never will be and never could be what the late John Rawls depicted it as being and hoped, sincerely hoped, I'm sure it would be, namely a purely political doctrine as opposed to what he called a comprehensive view that competes with other comprehensive views. Nowhere is the reality of contemporary liberalism as a comprehensive doctrine, a secularist religion, more plainly on display than in the moral cultural struggle over marriage and sexual morality. Liberal secularism will tolerate other comprehensive views so long as they present no challenge or serious threat to its own most cherished values. But when they do, they must be defeated in the name, for example, of preventing dignitarian harm, and their faithful must be reduced to a status that would get them out of the way of doing any harm in respect of opportunities in employment or contracting and other areas that, from the point of view of liberal secularist doctrine, cannot be made available to them if they refuse to conform themselves to the demands of liberal ideology. Now, of course, there will be some within the liberal community, Rawlsians and others, who will try to make some room for meaningful dissent, even in practice, and not just in thought and speech. They will go around to groups like the Lavender Law Caucus and honestly and vigorously make the pitch. They will make various arguments, principled and practical, for why government should avoid being too draconian in its treatment of dissenters. But they will lose the battle in the end. The very success of the movement to which they have given their allegiance will reinforce the belief among their compatriots that the movement's victories were victories of righteousness over evildoers. And expressions of dissent, even small ones, will increasingly be perceived not only as deeply wicked, but as presenting a grave and intolerable danger to the order of goodness that was, only after a long struggle and at great cost, achieved. So there is, in my opinion, no chance of persuading champions of sexual liberation that they should respect or permit the law to respect the conscience rights of whom they disagree in any of those with whom they disagree in any significant way. Now look at it from their point of view. Why should we permit full equality to be trumped by bigotry? Why should we recognize a right to discriminate? I think people who are on the conservative side dug themselves into a hole a long time ago with the thought that they could strike a grand bargain, because the grand bargain would entail them making the claim, we have a right to discriminate, please respect our right to discriminate. That's not a winning proposition in America, not at any time. Why should we respect religions and religious institutions that are incubators of homophobia? Bigotry, religiously based or not, really must be eradicated as we try to eradicate racism. The law should certainly not give it recognition or lend it any standing or dignity, even by granting religiously based exemptions. Why should those who hold bigoted views be permitted to hold faculty positions, or even be guest speakers at colleges or universities or in law schools? Why should they be tolerated in print or broadcast media, whether news, entertainment, law firms, or in the corporate world? Of course, people who hold conservative views on moral issues have long experienced discrimination in all these areas. But until recently, the discriminators felt it necessary to pretend that they did not practice discrimination. Why are there no moral conservatives on your faculty? Oh, it must be because they aren't bright or accomplished enough. Or conservatives love money more than ideas, so they gravitate toward business, not academic life. Heard that one? Or gosh, I don't know. What a mystery. Why are there so few people in Hollywood who hold or reveal that they hold conservative views on moral questions? Oh, why, that's another one of those mysteries, really just beats me. I mean, it's not as if there's a blacklist or something. But increasingly, it will be unnecessary to dissemble or maintain these pretenses. The answer will simply be, honestly, look, we do not tolerate bigots around here. The lesson, it seems to me, for those of us who believe that the conjugal conception of marriage is true and good and who wish to protect the rights of our faithful and our institutions to honor that belief in carrying out their vocations and missions, is that there is no alternative to winning the battle in the public square on the substance of the moral issues in dispute. However dark and even hopeless the cause looks, and even if the time horizon is 50 or 100 years, we're 40 years from Roe versus Wade, more than 40 years, and the struggle has been maintained. The grand bargain is an illusion we should dismiss from our minds, and even if we won't, it will soon be blasted out of our minds by the harsh realities that will now descend on dissenters from the liberal point of view. Of course, with sexual liberalism now so powerfully entrenched in the established institutions of the elite sector of our culture and fully embraced by the President of the United States and the Democratic Party and funded by innumerable hedge fund billionaires and corporate titans, some view the defense of marriage as a lost cause. Now, I think that's another mistake, one that those on the other side have every reason to encourage their opponents to make and ample resources to promote. We've all heard the argument or taunt, the acceptance of same-sex marriage on a national and international scale is inevitable, it's a done deal, you had better get on the right side of history, lest you be remembered in the company of Orville Faubus. Now, of course, this is what we were told about abortion in the mid-70s, and many demoralized pro-life people initially believed it. But it didn't turn out that way. A greater percentage of Americans are pro-life today than in the 70s, and young people are more pro-life than people of their parents' generation. The idea promoted by the abortion lobby when their cause seemed to be a juggernaut, that the American people will inevitably come to accept abortion as a matter of women's rights and social hygiene, proved to be spectacularly false. So I don't believe that there's a right or wrong side of history or in the inevitability of anything. Now, does that mean that the reverse is true, that the conjugal conception of marriage and the understanding of sexual morality and integrity, which is part of it, will eventually or inevitably prevail in law and culture? Well, no. There's nothing inevitable in this domain. As the left-wing but anti-Hegelian Brazilian legal theorist Roberto Unger used to preach to us in courses at Harvard Law School, the future will be the fruit of human deliberation, judgment, and choice. It's not subject to fixed laws of history and forces of social determinism. As the Marxists learned the hard way, the reality of human freedom is the permanent foiler of inevitability theses. Same-sex marriage and the use of anti-discrimination laws against dissenters will only prevail if defenders of marriage make their prophecies self-fulfilling ones by buying into them. Thank you.
The next few minutes, we're going to have discussion within the panel itself, and in due course, we will be taking questions to the panel from the floor. But let me ask if any panel member wishes to respond to any other panel member to anything that's been said so far.
I could say something specifically to Robbie. First of all, I have to own up to the use of the bigotry card by the gay rights movement, and just start by saying, the reason why the gay rights movement focuses on bigotry is because there's bigotry out there, and particularly in the early days of when the gay rights movement got started, surveys show us more than half of gay people had experienced physical violence by strangers. So when people assault strangers on the streets and beat them up with baseball bats, it's not because they've accepted the conjugal conception of marriage. It's because they've got very different motivations. Now, the rhetorical move that I think it may be sincerely felt by proponents of the gay rights movement, but is massively unfair to people who hold Robbie's views, is assimilating all objections to the full gay rights agenda to that kind of view. It's just not the case. The opposition to gay rights is a very heterogeneous set of views. And the reason why I get the kind of blowback that I do in the gay rights movement is because I think the people who I'm talking to see that and nothing else. And they hear Robbie talk and they think, well, that's not the real motivation. There's something else going on there. And it's like the thug who beat me up on the street. And it's just false. It's just a mistake. Now, with respect to, it is the case that Robert Frost was wrong. Liberalism can take its own side in an argument. If there is a view that's a real threat to implementing liberal aspirations, then the law is going to come down quite hard on it. So, I think it has to. So it would have been a mistake to have religious accommodations at the time to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, because too many people would have unapologetically invoked them and used them and defeated the purposes of the act. That's not the world that we live in. And it's already been the case for a long time that there are religious people who won't facilitate marriages that they object to, and they've generally gone undisturbed. Orthodox rabbis who won't celebrate marriages between Jews and non-Jews, Catholic clergy who won't celebrate marriages of persons who have a divorced spouse still living. So I'm less pessimistic about the future than you are.
Can I say something? Yes. I'd like to sort of make some comments that follow on that, and also that tie back to something that Professor Galston was saying. So in the Elaine photography case, which was mentioned, which is ADF's case, and they've done an excellent job in that case, the objection is not, the desire here is not to discriminate against gay people. The religious objection, as we understand it, and these are the kind of cases we often see coming in the door at the Beckett Fund these days, is an objection to being drawn into celebrating a religious ceremony, a same-sex marriage or a same-sex commitment ceremony, that the dissenter simply can, as a matter of conscience, participate in. That's a very, very different objection than an objection that is based on this crude notion of, I don't serve gay people, right? That's very, very different. We represent a family who cannot, in good conscience, host a gay wedding in their wedding chapel that they own. Same as I understand it for the Elaine photography. So that's a very, very different kind of claim than simply this crude discrimination against gays. The other thing is what Professor Galston was saying about Smith, giving this sort of minimalist protection to free exercise claims. In the Elaine photography case, of course, that was being litigated under the regime of Smith, because the Religious Freedom Restoration Act did not apply in New Mexico. There is a state RFRA in New Mexico, but the court ruled that it doesn't apply to a dispute between private parties. So there the litigation is under the Smith regime, and it failed. So the other interesting sort of coda to that is is that the cert petition that has been filed by ADF, which is very good, is based on the free speech clause and not on the free exercise clause. And I think that's a, I think it's a great free speech claim because of the nature of the business there, which is an artistic photography business that was essentially asked to create a visual story about this same-sex commitment ceremony. And the photographer was saying, I just can't do that. In good conscience, you can't make me speak like that. But you see a claim under the free speech clause and not under the free exercise clause there. And the last thing I'll say is that, of course, lurking in the background of that case is the same thing that's lurking in the background of the HHS mandate cases, because Elaine Photography is a for-profit business. So can they exercise religion? I believe it's LLC or something like that. Can they exercise religion? It's clear that they have free speech. Can they exercise religion? Hopefully we'll find out.
Any other comments?
Bill.
Oh, Bill.
Well, I am not now, nor have I ever been, a lawyer. I am, however, married to a law professor. And it seems to me that if you think about some of the issues we're discussing, the way I'm given to understand lawyers to do, that is to bring principles into contact with particular cases and then see what happens, we may be led into more perplexity and confusion about these matters, which I think is better than premature security that one possesses full knowledge thereof. So let me just give you an example of what I'm talking about. Obviously, you know, the one of the issues that's been central in the past couple of years is the relationship between the contraception mandate and the business community, and in particular, businesses owned by committed Christians. And an analogy has been proposed. Kyle quoted Ed Whelan, saying, well, that's like ordering a kosher deli to sell pork. Now, if that's the right analogy, then this shocks the conscience, et cetera.
That's why I used it.
Oh, that's why you used it. Okay. Right. But, but then the question is, well, is that the only analogy? Or can we use other analogies to test our intuition? So here are a few, and I'm not going to comment on them, but just list them. What about a business owned by a committed Jehovah's Witness who rejects blood transfusions and therefore insurance policies that cover blood transfusions? What about a business owned by a committed Christian Scientist who rejects most of what we regard as conventional medicine? What about a business owned by someone who rejects war on religious grounds and therefore rejects federal taxes because a portion of the federal taxation goes for national defense? At what point do we say that the relationship between the religious conviction and the public policy is sufficiently attenuated so that the public policy takes precedence over the conviction? I regard that as a very difficult question that doesn't admit of a yes or no answer. It's not like a switch, it's a rheostat, and circumstances determine cases here. And so before we accede to the kosher deli analogy, it seems to me we ought to consider some other possible analogies to see whether they alter our judgment in any way.
Does another member of the panel want to talk about the kosher deli?
No, but I'll raise another subject and just throw it up there for Andy. For more than 50 years, for our academic lifetime certainly, liberalism has, in its most orthodox forms, presented itself not as a competing comprehensive view, but as a purely political doctrine, as a kind of neutral playing field on which the competing beliefs about human nature and dignity and destiny and the human good and right and wrong would compete fairly. Now, as you know, throughout Now, there have been internal critics. I mean, Bill Galston is one. Joseph Raz, my supervisor at Oxford, was another. Michael Sandel is another. There have been internal critics, people who reject that kind of liberalism, but that was the orthodox liberalism and the way in which liberalism presented itself. In ordinary discourse, it was things like, you can't legislate morality, or you shouldn't impose your values on other people. So the idea was there was this neutral position in which nobody was imposing anybody's values on anybody else, but we were all able to play. I think, Andy, what this debate in the last 15 or 20 years has done is just blow that up, that that cannot plausibly be presented. Now, it might be very convenient. Liberalism first wins on this theory and then changes the game and admits that it's a comprehensive view that competes with other comprehensive views. And by gosh, we can take our side in an argument no matter what Robert Frost said. And if you're in the way, too damn bad, we're going to impose our values on you. So that's point number one. And then relatedly, point number two, even if one is persuaded that comprehensive liberalism is the right religion, there's another step, and I realize we don't have time today to debate this whole thing. I just want to flag this other step, which is moving to the judgment, defending the proposition that it is actually the view of the Constitution of the United States. You know, it could be the right view, but it happens not to be the view of the Constitution of the United States, unless you have a position under which or according to which whatever the right view is in virtue of being the right view, the view of the Constitution of the United States. So there you go.
Further discussion? Yes, Bill.
Well, having posed a question to Kyle, you know, it seems to me that equal protection or perhaps equal lack of protection requires that I pose at least one more, or two more, shall I say, both you may have guessed to Robbie. It's very simple. First of all, question one, what do you make of Andy's point about religious exemptions to civil rights laws? How do you respond to that? That's question number one. Here's question number two. Do you think the Bob Jones case was rightly or wrongly decided? Yeah.
I think that those questions are effective questions if you begin from the supposition that the traditional understanding of sexual morality in marriage is just bigotry, the way what went on in the Bob Jones case is just bigotry, and if we were asking for exemptions from civil rights laws, it would undoubtedly be based on bigotry. But if we proceed from the assumption that what motivates people who defend marriage and traditional sexual morality is not bigotry or animus or hatred, but a perfectly reasonable, what can be recognized as a perfectly reasonable view, even by people who don't hold it, a view that can be held by reasonable people of goodwill reasonably, then I think those questions just lose their force as gotcha questions. And I think people on Andy's side divide into two camps. The much larger one that has persuaded itself that any opposition to their views about sex and marriage is just bigotry, and the much smaller one who says, no, it's actually not. It's a reasonable position that I happen to reject, but I think it's reasonable, and therefore I'm really not that intent on giving people who hold those views no out. So it's no surprise to me that since Andy's in that second camp, Andy's willing to give poor Elaine, or whatever her name was at Elaine's Photography, a little bit of a break, as long as there aren't too many Elaines and, you know, they're quiet and it doesn't turn into a big deal.
May I say very briefly why I'm not happy with that response?
Sure.
Okay, because, you know, you have imputed to me a belief which is not mine. That is to say, I am perfectly prepared to grant that at least some people who believed in racial separation did so on grounds that were religious, that they genuinely embraced. You know, there is a long, long tradition in this country of honorable people finding biblical warrant for various forms of racial segregation and subordination. And it is not my view, and never has been my view, that those religious views were simply a cloak for bigotry and oppression. In many cases they were, but in some cases they weren't. And my question is, what difference does that make? Suppose, you know, because in the case of racial segregation, we made a social, a collective social decision that a certain practice could no longer be allowed to stand, regardless of the basis for that practice or the arguments sustaining it. And so the thesis that I must believe that racial segregation was pure bigotry, and if I'm asking you those questions, therefore I must believe that there's no difference between racial segregation and opposition to same-sex marriage, that's just not right.
I think that racial segregation and the idea of racial subordination and white supremacy is not a view that can reasonably be held by reasonable people of goodwill. And I thought I had attributed to you that same view. If that's not your view, if you think that it can reasonably be held by reasonable people of goodwill, then I did misattribute it to
well,
you.
Well, let me put it this way. It was never difficult for some sincere religious people to draw support for their practices from what they regarded as a literal and legitimate reading of the Bible. And I don't need to refer you to those passages because you know them as well as I do. So I don't regard that, as being unreasonable, but I don't regard that as being ungrounded, but I do regard it as a belief that was trumped and legitimately trumped by high civil concerns. And
have I heard you correctly, Bill, that you believe that it could be reasonable to support a system of white supremacy and racial subordination?
I didn't. Look, what you heard me to say was that certain people could honestly read the Bible to that effect. That's what I'm saying.
Now, but my proposition was about beliefs that could be reasonably held by reasonable people of goodwill. I don't believe that racial subordination and white supremacy is one of those. I do believe that either point of view on the nature of marriage is one of those.
Well,
could I?
Andy, go ahead.
So I guess it seems to me, my take on religious liberty is that one of the things that religious liberty means is the right to believe unreasonable things. So the question whether you've got a valid religious liberty claim shouldn't turn on an assessment of whether your belief is reasonable. So if there are religious outliers who believe unreasonable things, but it's possible to allow them to live the lives they want to lead without hurting anybody, you should do it even though they're unreasonable. There are a couple of different meanings of the word unreasonable flying around here.
Unless you believe that natural law and religion are the same thing, which some people do, but I don't.
Well, I think we'll leave that discussion where it is.
Wherever that may be.
And now we will take questions from the floor. I know there's one microphone in the center of the floor. That may be the only one I can't see. But we will take questions from people behind the microphone only. So please state your question and identify yourself, please. Name and city or organization, whatever you'd like to say.
I'm Richard Clare from Virginia. And
can you hear?
Can everybody hear me?
Can you speak up just a little?
A little louder.
I got to look closer to the mic.
Go.
Does
That's
that
better.
Help?
That's better.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Close to the mic.
In Windsor, the Supreme Court was dealing with a situation where the couple was married in a jurisdiction that recognized the marriage. I think it was Toronto, Canada. And they lived at the time of one spouse's death in New York, which at the time recognized the marriage. And the court compared that to the federal definition of marriage and said that the federal government does not have the authority under the Constitution to define marriage, that is a power reserved to the states. Now, since then, IRS interpreting husband, spouse, wife under ERISA and other laws and regulations dealing with benefit plans, pension plans, health and welfare, has come out with a nationwide definition, which is if the couple was married in a jurisdiction that recognized it. So it's the place of celebration that marriage must be recognized by all plans throughout the country.
Okay, and please get to your question.
Yes, the question is IRS, and by the way, DOL, Trump, you know,
DOL
came in
being
and adopted
the Department of Labor.
Department of Labor,
okay.
Said we will adopt the same rule. So doesn't that now constitute the flip side, where the federal government, two agencies, are adopting a federal rule that would usurp the rights of the states? For example, Virginia, where I'm from, that has a one man, one woman rule, and why can't employers, particularly those who are in one state, like Virginia, why can they not follow Virginia's definition?
All right, anybody want to take that question? Yeah, Andy.
So I'm afraid that the premise of the question is wrong, because the court did not hold in Windsor that the federal government has no authority to define marriage. Some of the amicus briefs made that argument, but that wasn't the basis on which the court made its decision. The court said that this was too sweeping a disability to impose on a named group, and so was invalid for that reason. But the idea that the federal government has no authority to define marriage, the court doesn't say that in its majority opinion.
Any other response? If not, next question.
Anthony Bruno from Los Angeles. Just a quick question for anyone on the panel who wants to take it. Has anyone considered the possibility that the success of the same-sex marriage movement, and I do agree with Professor Koppelman that I do see a trend line that's not moving in the other direction right now, could actually be its demise? Because the same-sex marriage movement relies on civil law, civil recognition. There are some religious sects that do recognize it, but and my understanding is there are very few. But with every success, I think the argument against, for example, multi-member marriage gets thin. I think a lot of the arguments made in favor of same-sex marriage can apply to multi-member marriage. And when you start going down that, does marriage kind of lose its meaning in totality, where it's no longer defined by reference to the civil law, and people start looking back to the religious definition in order to understand what it means? I mean, I could see at some point a political movement, and maybe even a judicial movement, to get licensing, that power of government licensing, out of, to do away with it, because you're licensing multi-member marriage, maybe polygamous relationships. At what point can it possibly really limit you? Like, same-sex marriage depends upon the civil regime. So, if anyone wants to think.
All right. I think that may have been directed to you.
Sounds like
again.
That one's for me. The idea that if there is something that doesn't have a neat bounded definition, then it means nothing at all, it's just not true. So one category where everybody knows what its outer boundaries are, even though nobody's been able to come up with a good definition of it, is religion. Nobody's been able to come up with a good set of necessary and sufficient conditions for religion, but we all know what it is. We know it when we see it. People come up with a definition and people respond, well, does that mean that Marxism is a religion? It's a comprehensive view, and so on and so forth. But it's a gotcha because everybody knows that it's not. So my sense is that even after the same-sex marriage movement, marriage has pretty clear cultural boundaries, and I just don't see them moving to polyamorous marriage.
All right. Anyone? Oh, yes, Bill.
There may be an entirely different way to think about this question, which I draw from a layman's reading of the Mormon polygamy cases back in the 19th century. And that is that the court on more than one occasion discerned and described a relationship between marriage, a marriage regime, and a political regime. And the argument that the court made against polygamy, or one of the arguments, was that throughout human history, polygamy had been associated with despotism and monogamy with democracy. And so, I'm not saying that that kind of argument maps easily onto contemporary debates, but it is a kind of argument that I think is available to people who would like to draw a line between where the law now seems to be and any breach of the dyadic norm of marriage.
Well, I think that would be a big problem. I mean, it wasn't a very good argument when it was made in those days. I mean, some of the worst despotic regimes in history were in monogamous cultures. And it would be very hard in the face of the challenge of polyamory to make the argument that there is some undermining of norms of democracy or the rule of law or civil liberties that would attach to the recognition of polyamorous partnerships as marriages. I can't imagine what the argument would look like.
Well, I'm suggesting, Robbie, and at this point, if you're asking me to construct a de novo up here on stage, I can't. What I am suggesting is that there's an entire category of civil arguments about marriage, arguments from the civil effect of different marital forms
sure.
that deserves to be explored. And I think you agree with me.
I agree with that, yeah.
Next question. Roger?
Yes, Roger Pilon with the Cato Institute. I want to come to Bill Galston's defense, which I normally am reluctant to do. He was putting to you, Robbie Sorry. George, a set of serious questions, which I think you were ducking. And I would put it to you this way. As long as our anti-discrimination law, as it has evolved over the last 40 years, is reluctant to draw a distinction between private and public discrimination, and reluctant to defend the private right to discriminate, you're going to be hard-pressed to answer the line of questions that was put to you by Bill without making very subjective distinctions between good and bad discrimination. And how are you going to get away from doing that? Because those are the kinds of distinctions that reasonable people can have reasonable differences over.
Bill,
that was a question to Robbie George.
Sorry.
I thought it was to Bill.
I thought you were.
I like it better if it's a question to Bill.
I know. Yes.
Roger, I have to confess, I leaned over to Andy and said, I'm just having trouble hearing people from the mic. It's kind of blurry. But let me offer a thought, and if it's not responsive, then ask Bill. I think there are realities of history that have to be taken into account when we talk about the use of anti-discrimination laws, especially in the context of our current pluralism and the challenges that a morally pluralistic society creates. And that is just the reality of this brutal, inhuman, unspeakable evil of slavery and the regime of white supremacy and Jim Crow, of subordination and exploitation that was put in place after slavery was formally abolished. That regime and its legacy had to be smashed. It had to be smashed. From the moral and political point of view, it had to be smashed. When we start looking at all of our differences, as if those who were opposed to us were the equivalent of supporters of slavery or segregation, were bigots and people motivated by animus. That's catastrophic. It's analogous to the argument ad Hitlerum. There was a real Hitler, for real. You know, even more monstrous than slavery. And there are occasions. The Pol Pot genocide, for example, in my own lifetime, when the argument ad Hitlerum was relevant. But most of the time, the argument ad Hitlerum belongs on the shelf, maybe even locked away in the cabinet, because the consequences of using it for the civility of our discourse and the unity of our bonds are just too grave. Now, Bill, you weigh in on that.
Well. I'm not going to argue with you about any of that, Robbie. I will tell Bibi what you said, however. but I would say to Roger, and this is sort of orthogonal to Robbie's answer, that it's my understanding, and please correct me, that even our anti-discrimination law does draw a line between the public and the private. For instance, the law of public accommodations draws the line when you're talking about homeowners who do renting below a certain threshold. And I would argue that liberalism, I don't mean as opposed to conservatism. I mean as opposed to theocracy or totalitarianism, but liberalism, the adjective that qualifies liberal democracy, stands or falls with the distinction between what's public and what isn't.
Absolutely.
If we can't draw that line, then liberalism is ruled out of court by definition.
Absolutely.
And what that means is that any liberal order must tolerate activities in what is called the private sphere that it may legitimately interfere with or outlaw in what it calls the public sphere. And then we can argue about where that line is.
Yeah, I agree with that. And of course, the real debate is always where are you going to draw that line?
Exactly.
And that's a legitimate debate, which can reasonably be conducted between reasonable people of goodwill who disagree on where you draw the line.
Hopefully in a civil manner, too.
Yeah.
All right, thank you, Roger. Next question.
Ilya Soman, George Mason Law School. Mm-hmm. I think this is a question primarily for Professor George, though probably others might want to weigh in. And you mentioned in your opening remarks that you thought that the idea of a grand bargain had been tried and failed, and that conservatives had offered a grand bargain, and liberals, or at least most of them, had rejected it. But it seems to me, I don't actually see, I would ask, what's the evidence that conservatives have actually either offered or been willing to accept the sort of bargain that you suggested, in that until extremely recently, the position of nearly all social conservatives was rejection of gay marriage, regardless of whether there are protections for civil liberties attached to it or not. And even until recently, the position was that there should be a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage throughout all the states, again, regardless of whether there were accommodations for religion or not. So what's the evidence that this is an idea that has failed as opposed to simply one that hasn't been tried, because very few, if any, social conservatives were even interested in it until very recently?
Robbie?
Well, it's been argued out in various states. We've had debates over whether there should be inclusions of religious liberty exemptions and conscience exemptions in the state laws. Very often in those states, Republican legislators, or in some cases conservative Democratic legislators, offered the bargain. In some cases, a couple of cases, I believe Connecticut is one, the bargain was taken. I don't believe it's a bargain that will last. I think now the folks on the opposite side will spend the next few legislative sessions trying to erode those exemptions and protections that they accepted reluctantly in order to get the marriage redefined in the state. Believe me, there are lots of conservatives and particularly lots of Republicans who wanted a way out of this thing that would not require them to actually defend marriage, but not make it look like they were just caving in to the other side so that they could go back to cutting taxes or cutting spending or things they like to do. But it didn't work, and it's not going to work.
The only thing that I'll say about the bargain is that the two parts of it aren't really related in that tight a way. So the Elaine Photography case, it's not a case about same-sex marriage. New Mexico did not recognize same-sex marriage. It was about anti-discrimination law.
Anyone else? Next question, please.
Right. It may be because I flew in on a red eye this morning, but I thought I distinctly heard Andrew Koppelman channeling Barry Goldwater.
You come to a Federalist Society meeting and look what happens.
That's terrible.
But it does lead me back. I was much more satisfied with Robbie's answer to Roger, who really stole my thunder on the public-private distinction. But I do wonder, If you can accept that the judgment that you have made regarding slavery, for instance, Robbie, is one that I'm not so sure we tried the public solution. I think I believe a lot of what happened was, desegregating schools was government action. And I think that what we did and what Goldwater objected to was a little bit more French revolutionary in that aspect. Now, I understand it was horrific, and maybe it was a very brave step for us to take, but for a traditionalist, in a sense, I'm surprised to hear you kind of embrace that lever at that point. And I ask you to, in Goldwater's memory, maybe to respond on that basis.
All right. That's the question.
All right. I am not now, and I have never been Barry Goldwater. Yeah, Case for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was that it made well-paying positions available to black workers, and the impact on black incomes was enormous. There was this big jump in the median income of black workers. I just don't think that there is, and you needed to have it broad because there was no way to pick out idiosyncratic religious outliers. The people who would have invoked that defense were too many. That's not the world we live in now. The only reason why you've got anti-discrimination law is when the discrimination is pervasive. That was the case in 1964. It's not the case with respect to gay people today, at least among people who are willing to overtly, avowedly discriminate. Just not that often going to happen.
Anyone else on the panel? If not, next question, please.
Hi. This is directed toward Professor George, but anyone can weigh in. I was wondering, for people who are interested in preserving traditional marriage, the reason that it's not we're losing the battle is perhaps due to an accident of history and the use of language. So, for example, back in decades past, like 1980s, the same people who oppose same-sex marriage are the same people who were very unsympathetic toward job protections for homosexuals and create a public relations issue for today. There's a bunch of haters who want to preserve traditional marriage. Secondly, the use of the term gay marriage focuses on sexual orientation. Rather, it's really a same-sex marriage, and same-sex marriage wouldn't necessarily be limited to homosexuals, but using the term gay marriage, it directs it on gays, and they kind of feel that they're being targeted because of their sexual orientation. And as a result, this causes a hijacking of the civil rights movement. So gays are now considered almost like blacks were in the 1960s, and you have people using the term marriage equality, which kind of rhymes with racial equality. And I think that was the conflicts of those three things have been a problem for people who are interested.
May I ask you to get to the question, please?
Right. Yeah. I'm just asking, do you think that that is the reason that they're sort of losing the battle?
Andy and I were both having trouble hearing. Could you give us a... I thought I got the part of the second question. Which was about sexual orientation in marriage, so that the debate about same-sex marriage is not actually... are necessarily a debate about sexual orientation. It's a debate about whether two men or two women, irrespective of sexual orientation, can be actually married.
Right.
That's how I understand
it. I agree with that. I mean, in the same way that so-called traditional marriage or heterosexual marriage, as it's so, or I prefer just marriage, doesn't have anything to do with sexual orientation. If you have a person, let's say a husband, who's a potential husband, prospective husband, who experiences same-sex attraction, he can still, as a moral as well as legal matter, be wed to a person of the opposite sex, and they can form a conjugal partnership. You know, the type of relationship that's ordered to and would naturally be fulfilled by the coming to be of children. That's happened throughout history.
Right.
In all sorts of different communities.
I guess my point is that there's the use of language and there's also the history. So the first part of what I said was that back in the 1980s, 70s, people who were opposed to gay issues like employment and housing are the same people who oppose same-sex marriage. So I think at least it's perceived that way. So you can basically call them haters.
So if I understand you correctly, you're not saying that the same people who today defend the idea of marriage as a conjugal partnership are the people who were racists. You're not saying that.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is a perception. So, again, back in the 1980s, there were people who were not sympathetic to gay rights. And I'm saying the inheritors of those are also the same people who are opposed to same-sex marriage. This gives the left a way of saying the people who are against same-sex marriage are just a bunch of haters. So I'm just saying those two things have led to, I think we're losing the battle because of that perception.
Yeah, I mean, there may be those perceptions out there. They're crazy. They're absolutely unfaithful to the historical record. It was a very conservative Catholic archbishop New Orleans, Joseph Rummel, who excommunicated Catholic politicians for their legislative efforts to block integration of Catholic schools in Louisiana. I mean, he excommunicated. People today, especially my friends on the left, seem to go into a fit when a Catholic bishop even speaks negatively about a Catholic politician who is pro-choice, for example, on abortion, much less threatens to deny them communion. Well, Rummel actually excommunicated them.
I'm taking care of it, Professor. Thank you. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. The program shows that we go to 2 o'clock, but it also shows that another panel starts here at 2 o'clock. So normally there's a little bit of a break between. But at this point, let me just ask you all to say thank you to our panel for a great discussion.